Welcome to the University of Wisconsin Foundation, Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast, featuring some of the University of Wisconsin's best and brightest faculty and staff. This installment features Edward Friedman, the Hawkins Chair of Political Science at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Good afternoon. I want to thank everybody for coming out on this record snowfall day. I think probably most of you know we broke the record of 76 inches of snowfall in one winter this morning. I'm pleased this morning to introduce my colleague, Steve Keene. He is the Director of Development for the College of Letters and Science. He represents the Department of Political Science. And he will then introduce our speaker. So, welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Susan. And thanks, everyone, for coming today. My travels across the country with Letters and Science alumni, particularly people who take classes in political science, quite frequently ask people if they have memorable faculty members time here in Madison. And I see Booth Fowler and our speaker today, Ed Friedman. Those are two professors from the political science department who are most commonly mentioned as faculty members who inspired them in their relevant areas. So we are quite fortunate today to hear remarks from Ed Friedman talking about the situation in China. Ed has been on campus now and has been a member of the political science department faculty in five distinct decades and is a valued asset of the department. He travels quite regularly doing outreach, sharing his expertise on China with academic audiences, with governmental audiences, and with the public as well. I've had the fortune of traveling with him a couple of times in the last year to audiences of similar sizes talking about the situation in China. So without any further ado, let me introduce Ed Friedman, who will share his insights on China.
Thank you, Steve. It's a genuine honor to be here, to be with you today. Having just said that, I hope I just didn't mess up my order of doing things. The topic is China as a superpower. I assume that most of you have been to China. Who's been to China? Yeah. This is a very knowledgeable audience. In terms of just for a name, anybody here ever hear of a Chinese named Yu Dan? You have? Oh, you have. I promised N and say something about Yu Dan. Is that okay? Okay. Okay. And I assume that you follow the news about China and you're particularly knowledgeable about China. So what I'm going to do is try to leave some time for you to make your comments and ask your questions. But meanwhile, try to say everything there is to say so that nothing is left out. How many of you visited China before the economic reforms began? How many have an experience of Mao era? Mao era, okay. Well, if you have, you know that the change has been extraordinary and rapid since the death of Mao in September 1976. The picture is one indication of it from Mao to the present President Hu Jintao. The difference is rather obvious on an observation. The world has never seen such a rapid, monumentally large and sustained rise as China is now undergoing. And the big question, of course, is what it means for the future of the Chinese people, for us, and for the whole rest of the world. And so what I'm going to do, with a lot of trepidation, is absolutely impossible. I'm going to project China's future. Now, you know you can't project futures in the United States. You don't even know the result of an election race, even after the votes are counted. In general, the argument has been made by Karl Popper in a book called The Poverty of Historicism that human political events in any sustained length of time are impossible to predict. And if you're not persuaded by Popper in general, there's a wonderful, more recent book by a gentleman named Holub called The Black Swan. Who's read Black Swan? We should all go run out and read Black Swan, which argues that in our age in particular, it's an age of extraordinary volatility, as with the recent loss of at least $400 billion in the subprime mortgage crisis, which no one could predict. And so if you think of the world in terms of normal bell-shaped curves, you're going to get everything wrong because you have to think of the world in terms of ruptures. But it's virtually impossible to imagine ruptures. We're just human beings just can't do it. We imagine the future as looking more like today. That's what realism is like. And so we can't really imagine different kinds of futures. I worked this past summer for the U.S. government on a project projecting China's future, asking the question, what would be the impact of information technology? And we put out a long report on it. But the key to the report is the back section where we have something called alternative scenarios. Because what if everything changes because of unexpected events? 9/11, oil prices surging, the rise of a China, the subprime crisis drying up a capital in the world, and whatever. In advance of the events, you literally can't imagine them. And so when you project futures, you have to accept as a fact that you're about to make a fool of yourself. And since we're all friends, I'm going to make a fool of myself in public, and you will all forgive me for it. Well, the first thing is that everybody knows that China has indeed risen. And there are cartoons about it, which I can't see. There is no doubt about the reality of the Chinese rise. The question is, what do you think about it? Is it good? Some say yes. Some say it dynamizes the world economy. It's good to have someone growing at a rapid rate. And it certainly is a fact that everybody wants Chinese tourists. There were last year 320,000 Chinese tourists in the United States. 90% of them visited Nevada. Um, 600,000 Chinese went to France. On average, they spent twice as much money as an American spent. And there's a general view that the rise, therefore, is good. It keeps the economy going. Another view, I'm going to give you an endless series of views here on what it all means, is that the rise of China is neither good nor bad. It just means that China's influence is going to increase, especially in its region. This is natural. An economic rise will bring more clout, militarily, economically, and in prestige, attractiveness, so-called soft power. And that nobody, and what this means in the long run, is that nobody in Asia will do anything which will upset China, because China does not like to be upset. In fact, you can even see countries, even democracies outside of Asia, working very hard not to upset the Chinese. If you pay attention to endless news detailed, yesterday there was a big brouhaha because the British Olympic Committee made all its athletes sign an agreement that while they were in China for the Olympics, they would say nothing critical about China. The British public screamed bloody murder and they withdrew the contract. But you don't want to upset China. This is natural. This is what is going to happen. There is another view which says the rise of China is not such a good thing, that China is going to become a military threat, not because China is uniquely evil, but first of all, that's simply how the world works. If you have more economic clout and you build a stronger military and you have a feeling that you've been victimized in the past by unfair history, you're going to do things to even them out, and a nasty nationalism will grow and China will do bad things. This is a quote from the premier of China, a gentleman named Zhao Ziyang, died a couple of years ago. He was a premier during the 1989 democracy movement who tried as best he could to prevent the tanks from going down Chang'anjie and slaughtering people who were supporting the movement. And he said, just before his death, nationalism will be the greatest threat. This is a threat that we outside China must, someone writing about it, must also regard with deep concern. It is still possible that China's communist leadership will manage to preserve its political power and retain its ill-gotten gains by continuing to suppress the populace while reducing the gap between rich and poor that poses the greatest current threat to social stability. But any such success is likely to make China's leaders even more arrogant and contemptuous of human rights, democracy, and justice. Such a powerful tyranny would inevitably constitute an even greater threat to the freedom and peace of humankind. So there's China as a threat. Of the analysts who I work with in the United States and throughout the world who specialize in China, most of them would make fun and mock anybody who thinks China could possibly be a threat. They see it integrating peacefully with the world. and they think that this is just an alarmist view of other kinds of people. And China mocking people who are worried about the rise of China, calling them China bashers, must be the norm, because Stephen Colbert uses it as a joke on his show. Here's Mr. Colbert. "People of America, we have got to stop China. Economically, militarily, technologically, they are catching up with us. We always used to be able to beat them because our New Year starts at the beginning of January. But check your calendars. Their New Year's is starting February 7th. And in 2009, it's January 26th. Pretty soon, they'll be celebrating New Year's before we do. Then they'll have a head start on us for the entire thing. It's very threatening." The dominant view about why there's nothing to worry about comes from an approach which is called market Leninism. The view is that China is in the midst of a transition, and half of the transition, the market part, has succeeded, and it's economically dynamic. But a political transition has not occurred. It's still Leninist. And this is a contradiction that cannot survive. Market Leninism is a contradiction in reality, not just in terms. And therefore, whether it wants to or not, China will have to undergo political reform, otherwise the whole thing is going to fall apart, and its nationalism will change, it will really integrate with the world, and we should all therefore relax, because if we just keep engagement with China going, these forces will have their way inside of China. The way it will work is everybody will get wealthy, middle classes will grow, people will care about their own interests, they will try to protect their own property, they will hate the corrupt rulers, and eventually they will make demands upon this system, and it will evolve into a democracy. So don't worry about it. Everything will work out okay. I actually think that is the dominant view among analysts, that everything will work out okay, that there is an inherent logic, and it's just going to happen to China, so therefore don't worry about it. There's another view which says you shouldn't worry, because the economy will actually fall apart or stagnate or decline, that they can't get out of the trap that they're in. Just to name three recent books that do this in case anybody has nothing better to do with their time. One is by a gentleman named Gordon Chang called The Coming Collapse of China, and one is by John Lee called Will China Fail? The other is by Pei Min Xin called China's Trap Transition. But the basic argument goes something like this. That China's rise is real, it's extraordinary, but you have this ruling party, which is not just in Beijing, it goes throughout the entire society, and the party is using this moment to rip off the society and entrench its own private interests. And they care most about those private interests. They are increasingly like what happened in the late Soviet Union when it became corrupt and stagnant, and they had no way out of the system. But what happened in the era of Brezhnev, called Brezhnevization. Deng Xiaoping, who was the predominant leader in China launching the economic reforms, thought that the reason the Soviet Union did not succeed was because Brezhnev came to power, and it was his worry that a similar thing was going to occur in China. Brezhnev stopped the Khrushchev reforms and created what became a stagnant period. And the view here is the same thing is gradually happening to China, and the whole thing will grind to a halt. The way this is argued inside of China, people who fear the same thing, they talk about Latin Americanization. It's a view that the country is polarizing. Without a doubt, it is polarizing. The gap between rich and poor is growing. The angers in the society are very, very real, and the regime is very frightened about these kind of angers. And Chinese analysts who worry about Latin Americanization think that the regime isn't going to be able to do enough about it, and eventually explosive forces are going to build up, or these corrupt forces will so entrench and repress popular forces that you'll end up in a situation much like Latin America, with old landed elites not being able to make the continuing dynamic changes as the world moves on. And so China will fall too. That's a very popular view among critics inside of China. In fact, an increasingly dominant view in China is that rather than being a success, China is a failure. And this view goes something like this, that the growth has been a growth at any price growth. And there's been no concern for what this does to ordinary people. And as a result, there's been no government investment in education, which Chinese care very much about. If you speak Chinese, you can get any cab driver very quickly to curse the government for not caring about education and investing in it. And so education is being priced out of reach. Housing is being priced out of reach. Medicine is being priced out of reach. The regime has invested in infrastructure. It's subsidized state-owned enterprises or firms with close ties to the regime, and the money is not being shared. College graduates have a hard time finding jobs, and the jobs they're able to find increasingly are very low-paying jobs but don't permit them a middle-class income, and rage is beginning to grow in the society, even in the people, the supposed middle classes who are supposed to be the beneficiary of the society. And the regime is now trying to run to catch up to deal with these problems before the Latin Americanization has its way with China, and it fails. My own view, if I'm allowed my own view, I gave you what I think are the major views that are out there, is something different than all of these things. My own view is that China has risen. Its impact on the world is clear, which I'm going to describe in a minute. It has made a transition from one kind of an authoritarian system to another kind of authoritarian system. That means it likes to live in a world, as all governments do, with governments which have similar values to the ruling group inside of China. That just seems safer to them. And as a result, it is going to be on the side of in continued repression in the direction of, if you will, unfreedom inside of China and outside of China. So here's a picture from an area in Beijing University, Beida, called Sanjiao. The triangle at the Beijing University essentially was a place where anybody could post anything. And it now looks like, we have the next one, they've made it neat and clean. There's no place anymore for you to post things. The point is, I'm going to try to show in a second, is when you visit China, in terms of what's really going on in the life of people, it's not visible to you. You cannot see it. What really matters is hidden from the eye, no matter how wise and clever and informed you are, that you have to be able to learn to see what isn't there. In other words, when you see that picture of that neat area at Beijing University, go back one, you really want to remember what isn't there. What used to be there. And I'm going to try to make you aware of that in a second. So my view is that the rise of China is pretty similar to the rise of Imperial Germany in the Bismarck era. It's pretty much like the rise of Meiji Japan in the late 19th century. And by the way, in saying that, I am not saying that the rise of Bismarck led to Hitler or the rise of Japan led to Tojo. Actually, it was alive with many possibilities. Germany could have ended up with a flourishing Weimar era. Japan had an era of parliaments and parties known as Taisho, and it's multiple potentials. So in saying that it's like Germany and Japan in the 19th century, I'm making no necessary predictions about the future yet. I'm going to make some at the very end. In visiting China, what can't you see? Well, I pick up a headline here from a web. China detained 70 in raid on Shandong House church meeting. Well, you can't see people who are meeting in house churches or doing other religious things that the regime doesn't like, and you can't see the repression on them. You can't see the regime manipulating the news. Take one recent event, which you literally cannot see. In a small village, there was a school, and since education is tremendously underfunded, the people who ran the school had the kids making fireworks in order to make money. Well, the fireworks manufacturer went wrong. It all blew up, and kids were all killed. The parents did not take it lightly. The story leaked onto webs. Foreign media picked it up. The government did not allow, they could roadblocks, you couldn't go and see it. the foreign ministry criticized the foreign media for spreading rumors. But you can't see what's going on there. You can't have an experience of what's happening in China. If you go to Tibet, you can visit the Potala Palace. You can see the colorful costumes, actually reading from a Chinese reporter. You will have the illusions, as Chinese writes, that people there are living an enjoyable life. When you see the flowers, the lovely kids, you will probably forget the human rights conditions there. And I think that is the norm, that we really can't see the human rights conditions there. But one of the reasons we can't see it, I think, is because we're trapped in the year 1991. And the year 1991 had a deep impact on American minds. Given 1991, what is happening today is virtually inconceivable. In 1991, China was being sanctioned by the industrial democracies for the murder of unarmed innocents on June 4th, 1989, the supporters of the democracy movement, which had been headquartered in Tiananmen Square. The Japanese economic bubble burst in 1991. The Soviet Union disintegrated in 1991. An American-led force took only a couple of days to defeat Saddam Hussein's Iraqi army in Kuwait after the Iraqi invasion in 1991. In 1991, people talked about a third wave of democratization, in which it was expected, as East Europe had just democratized, so would China. It was the future of the world. Instead, what we have to face up to is the extraordinary resilience of the authoritarian regime in Beijing. The rise of China, it seems to me, is reshaping the world, and not in a way that people who wish to see democracy and human rights flourish would prefer. In Southeast Asia, China is the major backer of the military tyranny in Burma, which, as you all know, just gunned down pro-democracy Buddhist monks. In Central Asia, in Uzbekistan, when the authoritarian president slaughtered a burgeoning democracy movement, Beijing invited the president to Beijing to be honored as a hero. In Africa, by the way, Mugabe in Zimbabwe has been awarded a visiting professorship in Beijing for his great management of the economy in Zimbabwe. In Africa, China helps the Sudanese regime responsible for the atrocities in Darfur to stay in power. It buys 60% of Sudanese oil. It supplies the regime with weapons. It keeps the UN from doing anything serious. And it is basically doing it because it's grabbing a financial opportunity. Human rights pressures got Europeans and American firms to back out. It was easy pickings there for Chinese firms to go in with nothing more than economic motives to make money and all the us follows. In other words, I'm not trying to imply any evil motives to anybody in Beijing. It seems to me this direction of China wanting to a world that it would feel comfortable in is very, very normal. Now, if you say these things about the Chinese government, the Chinese government response is that the first human right is food and clothing. And China feeds and clothes the Chinese people. Not all Chinese buy the government assertion. Here is, again, a Chinese commenting on this government assertion. Many first-time travelers to China are very surprised. The country is not as poor as they thought, and people have smiles on their faces. Those foreigners conclude that Chinese people have contented and wonderful lives. But those who only come to China one or two times cannot understand that this is indicative of China's people's attitudes towards life and their tenacious strength for survival. I cannot imagine that an unemployed worker in the West who cannot feed his family could go to a park every morning with his bird cages, or that a laid-off female worker would go into the streets to dance each night. According to my limited understanding of Westerners, their psychological or physical ability to tolerate life's misery is way, way below that of the Chinese. Of course, if you want to call this the optimistic nature of the Chinese, I'm not going to argue with you. For example, a street vendor who sells roasted sweet potatoes was beaten by the local police. With his face still swollen, he immediately tried out his English on the next Western passerby, putting on a charming smile and saying, "Hello, ni hao, welcome China." And this Westerner will conclude that Chinese people's lives are full of sunshine. I have seen too many of this type of events. I know that my ability is limited. My camera lens cannot really reach the essence of the emotions. But I think, does he have a wife? When he comes back home, will his wife ask him where his tricycle and his stove for roasting sweet potatoes went? And where did the money he made go? What's on the dinner table for his family? Will his wife ask him how did he get those scars on his face? But he walked away with a smile on his face all the way home. I suppose the first thing he would tell his wife is, my English is pretty good. Today a Westerner said hello to me. The regime, another response to the regime's claim that people are fed and clothed so it meets the most basic human rights is Chinese respond and say, monkeys in the zoo are fed and clothed for free. Is that a human kind of life? I'm going to read you a poem written, or published, I should say, on a blog this Sunday by a Chinese poet, a gentleman named Li Wei, who writes in Tianjin. I may not read the whole thing. It's not a great poem, but you'll get the point. It's called Me or a Monkey. To lessen the burden of the nation, the people, I, an average man, a completely inconspicuous person, a person of no contribution whatsoever to society, consent to give up from now on my title as a human. From now on, I will rapidly devolve into a monkey who is symbolically primitive. I think this for me is progress in thought and action, an improvement and a rising in the ranks, and also for those who are like me, for those who feel remorse towards the nation and its people. It's a kind of guidance and encouragement. I sincerely hope that myself as a devolved monkey will willingly walk on the rope that my master, who is a peasant, whose homeland has been swallowed by floods, I would agree upon the city's empty grounds in a short time before the police rush to disperse us, to perform my most famous tricks using all kinds of humorous and amusing antics, emulating and reliving my previous life so that I can earn a few pennies for my homeless peasant master. Spare some change for him to settle and for those laid-off factory brothers and sisters who happened by fate to watch me perform to their worn-out faces and hearts, I can bring some momentary happiness. Of course, the more beautiful hope is that the homeless peasant has a home, has land, has crops to harvest, that laid-off factory brothers and sisters have a stable income and social security, a civilized lifestyle of concerts, movies, leisurely readings. They all live carefree, healthy, happy. They all no longer need me, this monkey. Well, it goes on, but you get the idea of the response. From here. So my projection of China's future, understanding what I said at the beginning, that the future is going to make a fool of me and any prognostication that I make, is that China is going to pretty much continue as it is. It is a great success story. The economy will continue to rise. If instruments continue to rise, there will be unbelievable, unnecessary suffering at home, but it is not going to undo the regime, that the regime is stable, the regime is super stable. But then what about those alternative scenarios? What about if something unexpected occurs? What happens then? And in that case, I think it does open the Pandora's box that we talked about in talking about the consequences of Meiji Japan and Imperial Germany. And to get a feeling for that, I want to tell you two stories which you might find strange. One is about the cartoons at the beginning. All of those would show you how America is indebted to China and how China controls increasingly American purse strings as it buys the treasury bonds. The dominant view in China is the exact opposite. The dominant view in China is that America and American finance run the world. The dominant view in China is that those sneaky, clever Americans have gotten us to buy that bad money. And that money is going down in value, and we are losing money, and we are subsidizing them, and they intended it all along. That the people who are running the reform policy have fallen into an American trap. And we have to get out of that American trap and establish our true independence. And what is the content of this true independence? And this gets us back to Yudan. You want to tell them all who Yudan is, since you guys know? You don't want to tell them who Yudan is? Come on. No? Okay. Yudan is a PhD, a professor, a woman in Beijing. A very popular talk show person. She lectures on popular Confucianism. She sells books on popular Confucianists. I call her a Confucian evangelist. She makes millions doing it. And this it really is popular from highest intellectuals to ordinary kinds of people, because the change that China has been experiencing is so rapid and so discombobulating and so difficult to understand that the notion that the way to do things right is to go back to our ancient traditions, that Confucius probably was wiser than these selfish, decadent Western types, is very, very popular inside of China. And if you think of this combination of the vision that the outside world is always out there to get us and is succeeding, and we're not this great success story, we continue to be a victim. And you think about a popular view that the truth of the matter lies in going back to our ancient traditions and making and purifying ourselves of the defects and diseases and pollutions which come from outside. If there is a trauma, if there is a rupture, if there is an alternative scenario, my guess is that China's future, whatever else it's going to be far less nice for them and for the world than the happy dominant view in the profession of the natural evolution to democracy. So I tried to rush and do a lot, and I'll stop and open it up to any questions that anybody has about anything. Throw Taiwan into the mix. It's such a long story. Throw Taiwan. Make it a specific question so you focus my mind. Oh, as an alternative scenario. So Taiwan is a democracy. It's a still a flourishing economy. Maybe the way I can tell is the dominant image of Taiwan in China. Let's see if I remember the joke correctly. If you want to feel like a nobody, you should go to Beijing, because Beijing is where all the powerful people are. So whoever you are, you'll be a nobody. If you want to feel poor, you should go to Shanghai, because that's where all the wealth is. And given what I just told you, the ends about this discombobulation and feeling of chaos in China, it says, and if you want to feel tranquil, go to Taiwan. His view is that Taiwan is chaos. Taiwan is chaos. So I think for most people in China, Taiwan is not a positive image. One should not underestimate the government's power to control imagery of things that people do not live in their own lives. If it's in your own life, people see through government propaganda like that. They are super critical. I think they're more critical than reality deserves. But if you live in a system like China, you're so critical domestically about so many things that you have to prove, because you don't want to get into trouble and you want to think of yourself as a patriot, that you're loyal. And so on international issues, you tend to become 110%er. So you're open to swallowing the government line on Taiwan as a troublemaker and a causer of disorder and so on. And so it is not a positive image for most Chinese at all. Yeah. Never. Go ahead. Well, there are two things I would say. Actually, I do regularly testify to Congress, so I may not talk to the president, but I do get to talk to Congress, setting up another testifying session this morning. So two things to have in mind. One is China's rise is real. There's a lot of dangers involved in it, but we certainly don't want to be on the side of making worst-case things come true. We want to be on the side of making it as likely as possible that the better forces should win. So I'm totally in favor of maximum engagement with China, even more than we do now. I myself am involved in a multi-year project in the foothills of the Himalayas on sustainable development, the training and education. I think we should do all of those kinds of things. That we, of course, you have to hedge your bets too. But that's the basic policy that you should be doing. The second thing you want to keep in mind is that just because the Chinese government has a view that its place in the sun is restoring what it sees as its natural place as the dominant power in Asia, doesn't mean that other peoples in Asia don't deserve their place in the sun too. Taiwan, Japan, Southeast Asia, India, Mongolia, all of them would like to have their place in the sun. And they do not want to live their life subordinate to this People's Republic of China. So you have natural friends in the region. Not that you want to make an alliance to encircle or threaten China. You really don't. But in terms, you want to be able to have them secure that they have an alternative future than being subordinated to China. Now, in terms of what's happened in the last 7 years, the dominant view in Asia is that the American administration has been a disaster, doesn't care about us, and therefore puts its money elsewhere, and therefore we have no choice but China. So I think you want to make them feel that they have, not that they shouldn't get deeply involved with China and engage it like everybody wants, as I said, the tourists to come and what have you, but that they you help have give them an alternative to simply subordinating themselves to China. Your best deal is simply to be in favor as plural a political universe as possible. Okay. Oh, that's Chinese. That is the funniest line of Chinese propaganda. I should have brought my long list of books for you to read so you don't swallow such a silly line. No country is as big as China or America unless it knocks some people out of the way. It's an inconceivable kind of Brazilians, Russians. If you're big, you've committed big crimes. It is true that the Chinese people are educated in what I call Confucian pacifism to obscure for themselves the reality of this. But I can assure you that there is as much blood on expansionist Chinese hands as anybody else's hands on them. Genocide of the Dzungar Mongols. Invading Vietnam and killing 7 million people. Invading Korea 20 times. It's endless. And the only way they're as large as they are is by fighting wars and incorporating people. They have on this a French view of the world. You know, the French was never imperialist also. They had a superior civilization and everybody wanted to benefit from France's superior civilization. That's the Chinese view. We had a superior civilization and people came and said, oh, let your light shine upon us. If you read the French view, you can read the Chinese view. But everybody imagines, if they're not unique in imagining myths to make themselves have clean hands. Everybody does that too. My view is not that China is in any way more evil than anybody else. But what I would insist on, and this upsets many Chinese, they are human beings. I'm supposed to know the answer to that question since I'm part of a large NSF environmental grant. Any statement you heard about environmental degradation in China is probably an understatement. It's really very bad. And it's very much in popular consciousness. To give you show you how much it's in popular consciousness, I'll tell you a village story. I like telling village stories because that's where I actually do my work. So there was in this one village that I was working a chemical fertilizer plant which polluted into the neighboring streams, totally untreated effluents from the plant. And eventually this water is then used to irrigate the crops. It's used to for the tea that you drink and so on. Not surprisingly, there was a rather high rate of infants born not whole, to put it gently. And when a official's wife gave birth to twins, the popular gossip would be that while they're killing us, they have means to get chemical stuff that protect them and have their women give birth to twins. So at a popular level, people turn it into, as I like to say, things that are even worse than the reality. It happens all the time when you don't have open information kind of society. It must be that at least 1 million people die a year in China as a result of these kinds of things. Water levels are declining at just unbelievable kinds of rates. The glaciers in Tibet are melting. The regime is aware of it. It tries to do something about it. It has the just about the best environmental rules in the world. If you didn't know that, it does. It just doesn't enforce any of them. In fact, it doesn't pay for anybody to enforce any of them. The Environmental Protection Agency in China doesn't have any enforcers, basically. So people just get rich quick, and worst case, things continue to happen. So there are people who, in terms of why you shouldn't worry, I worry because I see people suffering, but see that this is going to be something which also will put a limit at some point on the growth, because the pollution of the water, the air, the soil, it's just quite extraordinary. Right. Everything you heard is true. Everything I said is true. Oh, she wants to know how I could say they're not investing in education when she heard they're trying to create the best universities in the world, the equivalent of a Harvard or an Oxford, and they're creating feeder schools for them. So aren't they investing in education? It is absolutely the case that the best universities are rising and have increasingly just absolutely first-rate talent. The major so-called MIT, Tsinghua University, is unbelievably subsidized by the regime and has a very high-quality faculty. In fact, the Tsinghua University guest house, so-called, is probably more posh than any hotel in Madison, Wisconsin. So there is a tremendous investment at that higher elite end. And it's also true that there's investment in elite feeder schools, but not in mass popular education, not in voc tech education, and the dominant. Well, let's go back with me to a poor village. Let's say I walk into a poor village. How do they pay the school teacher? Well, they decide the salary. They don't have very much money. They don't want to pay the person very well. The person is living all alone. It's a miserable life. The first thing the school teacher is trying to think about is how they get the heck out of there and get some other job. So Chinese statistics on universal education that they publish are total frauds. And the way the frauds are created, because it isn't that the central government is out to lie. It's the system that creates the lie. In fact, the central government, I think, wouldn't mind if it could get them to publish honest statistics. But it doesn't put much effort into it. So let's say you're a local poor rural county. And they say, what percentage of your people are graduating from high school? Well, you should have a high number. Well, the real number is maybe 30%. 30% doesn't cut it. They want a high number. So you say, give me the number of people who entered the senior year of high school. What percentage of them graduated? 95%? We have a 95% graduation rate at high school. That's how the numbers come out. Yeah. That's actually a great question. At the end of, can we go back to the first slide? So we got four presidents up there, and actually Deng was never president. Deng's highest official office during most of his term in power was honorary president of the China Bridge Association. he boasts basically, as I say, governed from behind the curtain. Muho. But the other three all held serious office. But Deng, of course, is the one with the biggest positive impact. So Mao, I apologize for doing this, but I love the Japan question. So everybody knows about the Nanjing Massacre, okay? I think I'm going to do this in terms of the Nanjing Massacre. Everybody knows about the Nanjing Massacre. It's a massacre which occurs in the city of Nanjing, December 37, January 38. There were about 400,000 people who lived in Nanjing. The Imperial Japanese military of Hirohito must have killed about 90,000 people. If you can do the math, that's about a Pol Pot level of slaughter. Not a nice event. What did Mao Zedong say about it? Nothing. How many times did Mao Zedong go to commemorate the victims of the Nanjing massacre? Never. Why? Nanjing was the capital of Chiang Kai-shek. It was the head of the Republic of China. From Mao's point of view, the people who died in Nanjing were counter-revolutionaries, reactionaries. Mao never mourned the death of counter-revolutionaries. Good riddance to trash. So Mao was silent about it. Silent. Deng Xiaoping comes to power. He ends the policy of class struggle that Mao had followed, and he wants to the whole Chinese people to rise. And under Deng, the Nanjing Memorial Museum is built. Anybody ever visit the Nanjing Memorial Museum? I'm the only one. To commemorate the victims of the massacre, which really did happen. And so the regime now with Mao gone, and you can no longer be an anti-imperialist. You want all the investment you can get from the foreigners. You want joint ventures. You want foreign tourists. You want to make money. Mao didn't want any of that stuff. So you need a new kind of nationalism. So the new kind of nationalism is going to appeal to ending the humiliations of the past, Nanjing massacre. And so they build that museum under Deng Xiaoping. When Jiang Zemin comes to power following Deng Xiaoping, he acts on this vision of Japan should recognize its historic mistakes, confess them, and recognize that it owes the Chinese people a lot for what it has done. Now, in Japan, I don't want to go into depths about Japanese politics, but when Jiang Zemin goes to visit Japan in 1998, it's 50 years since the Nanjing massacre, and Japan has been a democracy for a long time since then. And 50 years since the Nanjing massacre means if you're under the age of 60, you were under the age of 10. Well, wait a minute, 60. It's 30 years later. If you're under the age of 70, you were under the age of 10 when the event occurred. Now you know about the event because your teachers. Teachers are very left-wing in Japan, so they tell you about these bad things. And you feel that Japan is a peaceful nation, hasn't killed anybody since the end of World War II. It's a non-nuclear state. It's been fighting for nuclear disarmament. China's just exploding nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, even explodes them during the period between the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the Japanese asked them please not to do so. They just rubbed the Chinese face in it. And Zhang comes to Japan, and in the presence of the emperor, he basically lambastes them for writing history textbooks which don't tell the truth. By the way, it's true. They do write history textbooks that don't tell the truth. It's also true that the Chinese write history textbooks that don't tell the truth. For example, the Americans are responsible for the Opium War. The Americans really didn't defeat Japan in World War II. You probably didn't know that. Because you're not allowed to give a capitalist democracy credit for things like this. Anyway, he lectures at the Japanese, and the Japanese don't like him. There's a lot of anti-China sentiment that grows inside of Japan. So Hu Jintao, the final one there, is in the wings, and he comes to the conclusion that Jiang Zemin is a disaster, that our major adversary is the United States, and when we alienate our neighbors, we make them more reliant on the United States. And so as he comes to office, he has gone out of his way to conciliate the Japanese so as essentially to make it seem that the United States is less necessary for that image I gave you when you asked your Secretary of State question. So the policy has changed over the years. Way in the back. Such a biggie. First thing is that one of the changes from when they first started coming over in to the United States when Deng opened up to reforms is that they now can live on the web. And so if they want, they don't have to leave China as much as they used to. They can get their information on webs in Chinese. They don't have to interact as much with local people as they had to, in a sense, in the past. And I think you see that tendency. The second thing is that the Chinese government has, after the 1989 democracy movement, has worked very hard to gain control of the various Chinese student organizations on the campuses of the United States. This one was an independent organization. It was a long struggle with the Chinese government before essentially they surrendered their independence, meaning that they would no longer invite speakers who might discuss the democracy movement or human rights and things like that. Nonetheless, they live here. And I think that has impacts on people's consciousness, for good and for bad, which is okay. I mean, we have good and bad, you know, for good and for bad. I'd rather they be realistic than romantic, for good and for bad. The Chinese have increasingly been courting people to come home. Many people have done well. But the dominant view in China is if you go abroad, you probably shouldn't come home. You'll probably do better over here. There's a mixed view because many people are doing well economically who do go home with various skills. I think the major gain for the United States from it is the same gain we get from any other group of people abroad who become immigrants. They enrich and dynamize our society, and it's wonderful to have them contributing to the United States, and I hope they become Americans, and I love them all, even if they vote the wrong way. For going back to China, if you're asking the question, will they change China, I think they do go back with a more critical consciousness from having the experience of having lived abroad in a democratic society. And I could name some who act critically on the basis of that consciousness. But if China is going to change, it's going to change because of much larger forces inside of China. So I don't see them as making a huge change back in China, but it's all to the good would be my basic feeling. I can't think of anything negative to say about it. Go ahead. It'll keep growing. I think already the population may be 100 million larger than official statistics say, because I think there are many more baby girls in China than the numbers say. I think that the official numbers of missing girls is an exaggeration. I think there's a very large number of unregistered baby girls in China. There's a very large black market in adopting girls in China. There's many more black market adoptees of girls in China than there are foreign adoptees in China. A Chinese preference of a good family is a phoenix and a dragon, a boy and a girl. So I already begin with the notion that the population is larger than the 1.3 billion. I think it's about 1.4 billion. And the basic view that's out there right now, it will grow at least to 1.6 billion. Which you can imagine what it does to resources. Go ahead. Yeah. The regime thinks it's a very big problem for their future stability and growth. I think it's a very stable situation, and it isn't. But I don't want the regime to think that, because as someone who works in poor areas, I like to see them invest in the poverty. But my experience in the poor areas is wild, tremendous suffering. I mean, you have to walk into a daily situation of life in which you're thinking, should I buy medicine for grandma? Should I invest in the in whatever it is we're doing economically so we can make some money? Or do I put it into a junior boy or girl's education and I can only do one? And you have to make these hard choices. So it's a tough place to live, and people live on pennies. And many of them, as you say, have not benefited yet from the growth. But I also think that the dominant view in the countryside is a combination of two views. One is that there's opportunity out there. So that, for example, if Lao Wang comes home and he says to his wife, it's not my fault that I have no money. The system is rigged. It's corrupt. It's all networked. You have to be a member of these party teams. It's not my fault. Old Lady Wang says to him, well, how come old Lady Li's husband is out there in the city and he sends home money all the time? And as long as old Lady Wang can keep saying that, and she still can, I see it as a very stable society. So I don't see the other part of the popular consciousness is there is no popular consciousness that the people who are rich have gotten there by entrepreneurship or creativity or hard work. The dominant view is they've gotten there by corruption and networking. And so the regime, in a certain sense, and the wealth created by the reforms is absolutely illegitimate at the very same time. Now, I know that's a contradiction, but Chinese are as complex as anyone else, and they can live contradictions as much as the Americans, who will tell you that the Congress stinks, but their member of Congress is the greatest person in the world. And Chinese similarly live contradictions, just the way the world is. Go ahead. Southeast, yeah. Let's put aside the racist prejudice about Japanese clean, Chinese dirty. I understand that. I understand that. But let's just put that aside. It is true that Chinese historically live in rural areas closer to animals than a lot of other peoples do in their in densely populated areas, and that therefore things more easily jump from animal species to the human species in China than a lot of other places. And so a lot of these kinds of things historically come out of southern China, which is where this place is maximal. And in fact, your description is not as bad as the reality was. When the World Health Organization's team finally went to Beijing and heard about the hospital and went to visit the hospital, the Chinese took all the patients out, put them in ambulances, and rode them out around the city until the visiting team left. Again, Chinese are people. So, of course, there were doctors, there were scientists, there were journalists who wanted to get the truth out, who wanted to cooperate, who wanted to do the right thing. Some of these people became heroes. This is part of the issue of this regime putting out a set of lies. And so if domestically, as I said, you have any experience of things, your actual view of the regime is even worse than the reality, because you begin to, I've heard stories inside of China which are far worse than what we know the reality is, because they hide so much of the truth. But you want to know about the cooperation. At the moment, the cooperation remains minimal because the regime experiences the need to control its public image, and it does not want to surrender the ability to control the public image of the regime to international forces who obviously are malevolent, otherwise they'd be Chinese. So there is not much of the kind of cooperation that, as you suggest. And to get back to our gentleman's question from Taiwan, so for example, it not only went to Hong Kong, but there is no road between Hong Kong and Taiwan. It's a waterway. And so there's a plane every 10 minutes from Hong Kong to Taiwan. So it quickly spread to Taiwan. Now, Taiwan is not a member of the World Health Organization because China won't let it in. And so China would not allow World Health Organization aid to go to China unless it went through a Chinese group. So it would be a Chinese-approved aid. And, of course, Taiwanese were not about to allow that happen. So there was then more unnecessary suffering in Taiwan because of the politics of the situation, too. I am told that we will have a last question, the benediction. Well, I may be very naive on this. Most people are of the view that their goal was to clean up the environment, and they aren't doing it, and it's going to be a disaster. They have actually tried very hard to clean up the environment. They have kicked polluting factories out of the city. They have banned the most polluting cars. They're experimenting in various ways of keeping cars out of the city. But the growth remains so strong that anything they've done has been countered by the continuing consequences of growth. So it's still basically in the same situation it was when they began to deal with the problem. So the dominant view is that they're going to have a public relations disaster in some sense on their hand. I think it's going to be an unbelievable success. It will be an extravaganza that they will absolutely succeed in putting China's best face forward. And you will see an Olympic performance of a splendor that you have never seen before at a great cost to the Chinese people. I flew into Shanghai from Beijing the night of the day that Beijing won the 2008 Olympics. And the dominant view in Shanghai was they'll build it. They'll build all the stuff in Beijing with the money from the people of Shanghai. So there's a complex view inside of China, but you mark, I may turn out to be naive, but I think it'll just be a tremendous public relations plus for the PRC. Okay. Thank you all for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this installment of the Bascom Hill Society Showcase Series podcast. For more information on this and other topics, please visit the University of Wisconsin Foundation homepage at www.uwfoundation.wisc.edu.